As our world becomes increasingly interconnected, so do the risks we face. But with the right context, we can uncover deeper meaning. Moody's decodes risk so that you can act with confidence. Visit Moody's.com to see how your organization can decode risk and unlock opportunity.
The Economist. Hello and welcome to The Intelligence from The Economist. I'm Jason Palmer.
And I'm Ora Ogunbiyi. Every weekday, we provide a fresh perspective on the events shaping your world.
Europe's bureaucrats would like to hammer out policies that protect the EU's high-value industries. But copying America's heavy-handed approach wouldn't work for 27 separate, disparate states. We look at one country that does provide a useful guide.
And have you ever wondered why hearing your favorite song performed live is just so much better than listening to the recorded version? Well, listen up, because we're bringing you the science. First up, though,
so this year, India is going to the polls in the world's largest general election, and the ruling BJP party is expected to win yet again and give Prime Minister Narendra Modi a third consecutive term. But as far as they're concerned, that's not enough.
Jeremy Page is our Asia diplomatic editor.
They want to significantly expand their political footprint from India's poorer northern heartland to the richer and better educated south of the country. And to see what the party's election campaign in the south looks like from the inside, I've spent 3 days on the road with a man called K. Annamalai, who leads the BJP in Tamil Nadu, the south's most populous state.
Talk politics, I'll just give you a lay of the land.
Sure.
Probably India, politically, economically, what has happened, how BJP emerged.
Mm-hmm.
And why south now? Mm-hmm. Why are we talking about sitting here talking about southern politics?
It was a fascinating, if slightly petrifying, 3 days. Petrifying because we spent a lot of time driving across Tamil Nadu at high speeds in a motorcade with an armed police escort. And given the number of hazards on Indian roads, that is a white-knuckle ride. But it was intriguing because I spent several hours chatting with Mr. Annamalai himself, and I got to see him doing a series of marches and rallies on what was the final leg of a 7-month tour of the state. I even got to join him at a bout of Jallikattu, which is a traditional bull taming contest in Tamil Nadu, where he'd actually entered one of his own bulls, which he named after Mr. Modi. And this was all building up to an appearance by the Prime Minister at a rally near the city of Coimbatore in the west of Tamil Nadu on February the 27th.
Coming to Pallaram and being with all of you is a great pleasure. This Kongu region of Tamil Nadu represents India's growth story in many ways.
He mentioned several things in that speech. He spent a fair bit of time talking about central government welfare schemes down in Tamil Nadu. But one of the really interesting things was that he paid a particular attention to talking about his love, appreciation for Tamil culture and language, which is a very sensitive issue down here. And this is all part of a big push in the south that has been years in the making. After the last general election in 2019, the BJP did an internal survey of constituencies where it lost, a lot of which were in the south. And since then, it's really focused a lot of its electoral firepower on the region.
So this big push in the south then is really just about improving its electoral chances next time around?
That's partly what's going on. The BJP is already very strong in the north and central and western parts of the country. But in the last general election, it won only 18% of the southern vote and 29 of 129 seats in the five southern states. It also wants to undermine its main national rival, which is the Congress Party. Congress governs a couple of states down in the south. More than half of its national parliament seats are in the south as well. And the BJP basically wants to displace Congress as India's only truly national political force. But there are also compelling economic reasons for the BJP to shift its focus south. Mr. Modi's image rests to a large extent on his claim to be an effective steward of the world's fifth largest economy, its fastest growing major one. The awkward thing for him is that the south of India has generated much of India's economic success. It's the south that's home to most of its big technology companies. It's where a lot of the high-tech manufacturing is done. It's where a lot of these global capability centres that foreign companies are now setting up are based. Tamil Nadu alone accounts for about 16% of all of India's factories. So the BJP really wants to take ownership of what is India's economic engine.
And what's the backstory to the disparity here? Why is it that Mr. Modi, the BJP, has had such trouble getting some traction in the south?
Well, the economic disparity has been there for some time, but there is also quite a deep cultural and political divide. One of the BJP's problems is that its Hindu nationalist ideology goes down very well in the Hindi-speaking north and central parts of the country. But it doesn't play as well in the south for a number of reasons. One is that in the south, Islam arrived a lot earlier and it spread more peacefully. The region also has a long history of social activism aimed at modernizing Hinduism and promoting local culture and identity. And the BJP's challenge is particularly acute in Tamil Nadu, which is one of the reasons I wanted to go there. That state has been controlled since the 1960s by political parties that stem from something called the Dravidian movement. That began as a revolt against local Brahmins, who are the highest group in India's caste system. And they used to dominate the civil service. That was one of the reasons for that revolt. And that movement then grew into broader campaign to abolish the caste system entirely and to revitalize local culture and language.
Right. So the BJP then has plenty of reasons to try to win over voters in the south. And you specifically went to Tamil Nadu and spoke with Mr. Annamalai about this. How does he figure into this whole story?
Since the last general election in 2019, the BJP has replaced all of its leaders in the south, and Mr. Annamalai is one of those new faces. He was actually a police officer in another southern state, Karnataka, until 2019 when he resigned. And then a couple of years after that, he was made the state president, which is a local leader of the BJP in Tamil Nadu, which is a very important job for the party. He's a young guy, he's only 39 now. He was 37 when he became head of the party in Tamil Nadu, and that was a highly strategic move.
I'm a farmer by profession.
What?
So if you have time, I would love you to come to my farm sometime and see what I do for a living.
He is a Tamil, he's the son of a farmer, and he's from a relatively low caste. So one of the ideas was that his appointment would help to counter accusations that the BJP is run by Brahmins from the north. But Mr. Annamalai is also pretty charismatic. He's a good talker. And he has, in the last few years, run a very aggressive campaign to mobilize young voters, especially in rural areas.
But for the party at large, one, even if a very effective local face, is not the entirety of the battle, right? The nationalist message issue that you mentioned before is going to be quite hard to overcome in the south anyway, right?
Yes, that's right. And one of the really interesting things that I observed in following Mr. Annamalai for those 3 days was that he really seemed to be toning down some of the BJP's rhetoric. So he was focusing a lot less on those Hindu nationalist talking points, a lot more on development and welfare in particular.
Tamil Nadu 2024, for the state of Tamil Nadu, it is more on the growth, growth and growth. How Tamil Nadu should not miss out on the India's growth story.
Mm-hmm.
How Modi's next five-year term, Tamil Nadu should be a part of the growth story. That is important for us.
Mm-hmm. One of the points he made was that Tamil Nadu's recent economic success was to a large extent due to central government subsidies. Obviously, the local government would dispute that. But he makes the case that the state is losing its competitive edge in attracting foreign investment, especially in advanced manufacturing.
So Tamil Nadu is essentially seen as a state that is not doing very well now, that is becoming a sick state, where the political corruption is so high, the cost of doing a business in Tamil Nadu is so high. So what is happening? The state is losing out opportunities to other states now.
And he's also trying to focus the BJP's campaign more on allegations of corruption and dynasticism in Tamil Nadu's ruling party, which is known as the DMK. And of course, the DMK denies those allegations.
So what's your read on how all of this is going down so far?
Well, certainly Mr. Annamalai was very enthusiastically received in the three places where I saw him campaigning. He attracted big crowds, and a lot of people in those crowds said that they would vote for the BJP, some because of Mr. Modi, some because of BJP policies. But that was a self-selecting group in a way, you know, that turned up for these BJP rallies. And it was interesting that in doing a number of interviews with people not in those crowds, there was a lot more skepticism about the BJP, especially over its Hindu nationalist ideology, and clearly quite strong, enduring support for the local ruling party, the DMK. And I think there's another sort of big question around this election, which is it's unclear how far the party's willing to go in softening that Hindu nationalism. If you look at recent public statements from BJP figures in the south, in Kerala, for example, BJP officials have accused young Muslim men there of engaging in what they call love jihad, accusing them of deliberately seducing Hindu and Christian women in order to make them convert, which is basically a sort of conspiracy theory. And in Tamil Nadu itself, Mr. Annamalai has been sued over his suggestion in a YouTube interview a couple of years ago that Christian missionaries sought to ban firecrackers during the Hindu festival of Diwali. Mr. Annamalai denies any wrongdoing.
So taking all of this in, it sounds as if it is still going to be hard for the BJP to get a foothold in the south.
Yes, I think that's fair. The BJP's prospects in Tamil Nadu this year are limited. It may gain a few more seats. But I think the important point is that it has a long-term plan. There are state elections coming up in Tamil Nadu in 2026 and then again in 2031. And so its plan is to gradually expand its footprint with a view to taking power in the state within the next 10 years.
Jeremy, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
As our world becomes increasingly interconnected, so do the risks we face. But with the right context, we can uncover deeper meaning. Moody's decodes risk so that you can act with confidence. Visit Moody's.com to see how your organization can decode risk and unlock opportunity.
These days, views of economic security are intimately tied to control over who can buy what, which countries can buy your most high-tech tech on an open market, or sell their best stuff into your domestic one, or invest directly into your tech sector. America has made stark moves on these questions, passing laws that prevent chip technology being shared with China, laws that tip the scales on what gets made at home.
Today I'm signing the law of the Chips and Science Act. A once-in-a-generation investment in America itself.
Late last year, the European Union brought in its own similar legislation. Yet for a coalition of 27 different nations, America's blunt, pricey, top-down way of doing technology policy might not sit well. Perhaps there's another country that offers some useful lessons in well-governed unity.
So the EU is trying to find its own approach on how to deal with economic security, how to restrict technological exports, how to do investment screening.
Christian Odendahl is The Economist's European Economics Editor.
In Europe, that's a very tricky balancing act between trade openness and security, and of course a very difficult task to get all 27 member states onto the same page, and ideally agree with the Americans too.
So how do those member states propose to do this, to monitor, restrict exports, to look across foreign investment?
Well, your question goes right to the heart of the matter. In the EU, which is not a superstate, most of these issues are indeed national responsibility because national security is a national matter and not an EU matter. And so what the EU Commission tries to do is try to overcome this and push countries to at least coordinate their policies. And on how to deal with investment coming into the EU, for example, Chinese investors buying a port or a robotics firm, there the EU has made some progress and is now adding to that by making sure that such investments are screened, that all EU countries have their voices heard on the national security implications, even if it's not their own country, etc. And that is the type of EU progress I think we will see in sort of agree on a regulation that prescribes how to do this in general and then build on that regulation in the future. But the European Commission was also a bit too optimistic on what can be achieved, I think. Ursula von der Leyen, the Commission president, had a meeting with President Biden in March last year. And the statement after that meeting read a bit like the EU and the US would now go hand in hand on these issues, such as outbound investment screening or export restrictions of new technology and so forth. And here, all the EU could agree on was that basically more analysis is needed.
That is to say, that statement was misleading. The EU will not necessarily go hand in hand with the US on all these questions.
So the EU is not a geopolitical player on a global scale like America is. It does not have this singular focus on containing China. And so some European countries, for example, have very deep economic ties with China. So the approach needs to be a bit different. It needs to find a balance between economic advantages and trade openness on the one hand and economic and national security on the other. And all that ideally without wrecking the international trade system and order, which is still very important to the European Union, which is itself a very trade open and rules-based bloc. The EU's interests are a bit closer to those of Japan. And Japan has been playing this game for a bit longer than many in Europe, so there is a lot to learn from them. And the first step there is, of course, to understand what Europe's strategic interests are and where vulnerabilities are in terms of its economic security, which technologies could be misused and how to protect them, and how to make European economies less vulnerable to economic blackmail. And the good thing is that each country in Europe is now assessing that and doing the analysis, but they're discovering that this is quite hard, and this is roughly where we are in Europe.
Okay, so carbon copying the US approach wasn't going to work. Perhaps something more Japanese might work. But again, the question, once all of these assessments have been done and all the analysis has been done, how to find a common ground and a response that's going to work across the whole union?
Yeah, indeed, that's very difficult. And I think, again, the comparison with Japan is instructive here, because one of the key advantages of how Japan does these things is what one expert calls a unity of purpose. So you have the government and businesses working together based on a common risk assessment and also with sharing of sensitive information between them. And contrast that with the EU, where 27 different countries work together, some with a very different political outlook. For example, Hungary, which is open to Chinese investment, which undermines the EU's approach towards Russia wherever it gets a chance. Then there is data, which is limited, and the sensitive stuff is not shared between member states at all. And that makes it quite hard to find a unity of purpose. So ideally, the EU should move some of those policies to a higher political level and create a common responsibility, a European responsibility for these, such as the EU does with trade policies, for example, where the EU Commission negotiates on the member states' behalf. Japan has even created a cabinet minister of economic security, right? But the EU is far away from that as it stands now. There's very little desire to give up sovereignty and task the Commission. The bigger countries in particular do not trust the Commission with such a delicate task. So what the EU is now trying to do is at least to elevate the issue to a higher political level and have a sort of higher level coordination group. I know that sounds very European and very EU, but that is actually a very important start to get this discussion going on what the strategic direction of Europe should be.
But it's going to necessarily be a mishmash then of perhaps some influence from American doings, but also Japanese. The EU will find its own way.
Yes, the EU has to find its own way. And maybe it's not quite fair to just use Japan as the comparison, because Japan is just one country and it has plenty of experience with economic security already. So, for example, it was at the receiving end of Chinese retaliation on rare earth exports in the early 2010s. It also has these close ties between business and government that the EU on the highest level does not have, only on the national level. But I still think there's a lot to learn here, because one of the aspects of Japanese economic security policy is to make Japan indispensable to the world. For example, by having some of the best high-tech firms in the world be global leaders on certain technology and so forth. And the EU's approach so far is a bit too defensive and too reactive to whatever America does or plans to do. So I think it helps to take some lessons from a country that did economic security before it became a buzzword.
Christian, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
In a world of music streaming services, you have access to almost any song you like with just a few clicks. But yet, the live gig still lives on.
Ainsley Johnston is a data journalist at The Economist.
People fill sweaty basements, muddy fields, and gilded concert halls to hear their favourite musicians play. And now neuroscientists think they know why. They've discovered that live music engages the brain's emotion centers more than recorded music does. Concerts are immersive and social experiences. People feel the music together. They're there through the crescendos, the key changes, and the drops, really experiencing it. But live music is also dynamic. Artists can change how they're playing depending on the crowd's reaction. They can up the energy or they can bring it down depending on what the crowd is doing. Neuroscientists based at the universities of Zurich and Oslo wanted to study the brain responses of people listening to live and recorded music. So they got participants to lie in an MRI scanner while they listened to music through earphones. In one of the conditions, the participants were listening to music that was played by a pianist live, who was positioned outside the room. And in the other condition, they were just listening to pre-recorded versions of the same tracks. Obviously, the participant, or the audience, couldn't really react to the music. If they moved around or danced inside the scanner, that would have messed up the recordings. And the pianist couldn't see the participant either. So instead, the pianist was shown the participant's real-time brain activity as a form of feedback that they could adapt their playing in response to. The scientists were interested in how live music affects the brain areas that process emotions. So in this live condition, the pianists were told to try and modulate their playing in order to drive the activity in one of these emotion areas called the amygdala. They found that the live music had far more emotional impact in terms of the brain. Whether the music was happy or sad, listening to the pianists playing live generated much more activity in the amygdala and other parts of the brain's emotional network. And the researchers also found that the participants' brain tracked the acoustic features of the music, so things like the tempo and the pitch, far more closely when the music was played live. This study is far from replicating the experiences of a real gig. But the results indicate that the ability of an artist to change the way they're playing in response to their audience might be one aspect that makes live music so special. There are some musical acts that are now attempting to recreate the live gig experience with everything but the artist. If we think of ABBA Voyage, this is a social, immersive show that's performed by pre-recorded hologram avatars of the band. But without Benny's ability to read the mood of the room, it may never quite match the real thing.
That's all for this episode of The Intelligence. Have you signed up to Economist Podcast Plus yet? I cannot stress enough that you're missing out on some of our best work. And if you've been thinking about subscribing, might I interest you in a deal? Until March the 17th, you can get an annual or two-year subscription to Economist Podcast Plus for half price, less than $2.50 a month. So go on, follow the link in the show notes to find out more and get a wealth of insights from our award-winning shows. And we'll see you back here tomorrow.
As our world becomes increasingly interconnected, so do the risks we face. But with the right context, we can uncover deeper meaning. Moody's decodes risk so that you can act with confidence. Visit Moody's.com to see how your organization can decode risk and unlock opportunity.